Hey everyone, Bad Audio, Future Chase here. Just wanted to wish you all a happy new year. We're sorry our output fell off a cliff last year, but we've been banking shows and I think we're ready to go weekly again. We'll see how long we can keep that up. Some of these first episodes that are going to be coming out were recorded a long time ago, so apologies for any dated references. A few quick announcements. The website is down. I'm hoping to have a new one up soon. Might be at a different URL. I will keep you all posted. Also, I am no longer on Mastodon. Wasn't really working for me, but I am on Blue Sky now. You can follow me at snescapades.bsky.social. Blue Sky and Instagram are probably the best ways to contact me right now. If you're not on Blue Sky and you would like to be on Blue Sky, drop me a line. I might be able to help you out with that. Finally, if you're not listening to Namely 90s and haven't heard their 12 Days of Christmas specials, you should really go do that. Emmy and I were on the first episode of their Christmas specials this year, talking about the Christmas episode of The Adventures of Pete and Pete, a show that I love dearly. So go give them a listen. That should be about it for now. Thanks for sticking with us through all of this, and on with the show. Out to Clay. It's Snescapades, a chronological journey through the North American Super Nintendo library with a few pit stops along the way. We play them briefly, we judge them harshly, we rank them. That is pretty much all you need to know. I am Chase Keys.
And I am Emmy Zero.
And we've got more games for you. We've got three of them, to be precise. Sorry, I don't have any beer bottles to put on my fingers right now for the thing. But
that was good though. I liked that. That was a kind of a sideways approach to the reference. So I like that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. So okay. This is season two, episode three. Yeah, we're still back here in good old November 1993. The third of three featured episodes for this month of the calendar year. Yeah, these are the last three games that we are going to devote the kind of normal classic Snescapades amount of time to before we move into kind of a quick fire wrap up episode for the month. What do we have today for the people, Chase Keys?
Well, we are serving up the delicious dish that is Out to Lunch. Then we've got we'll serve up some okonomiyaki, I guess. We've got Ranma One Half Hard Battle, and then I don't know some kind of weird amorphous dessert product. We got Clay Fighter.
I would not eat any of the Clay Fighter characters personally.
Not even Taffy?
Definitely not Taffy. I don't like his look. I don't like his.
Okay.
I think he's got ill intent. Basically, I don't want that inside my body.
I don't know if any of the Clay Fighters don't have ill intent, to be honest with you.
But
we'll get into it. We will get into it. Hey, should we talk about Out to Lunch?
Yes, let's do it. Let's talk about Out to Lunch, or as it is fully titled, Pierre Le Chef is Out to Lunch.
So, this is developed and published by Mindscape. This came out on the Super Nintendo and Game Boy in 1993. Was ported to the Amiga and Amiga CD32 a year later. This is kind of a simple arcade-style platformer. You play as Chef Pierre. He is a world-renowned chef, but his ingredients have escaped.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. As Chef Pierre, you have to go through many levels, chasing them down, catching them in a net, and depositing them in a cage, all while looking out for bacteria, which makes your food go bad and it will become aggressive towards you. And also Chef Noir, who will try to open the cage that you've deposited all the food into to let them escape. I guess because he's just a jerk.
Yeah, I guess. I kind of feel like what if Chef Noir is the good guy here? Because, like, these, like, potatoes and mushrooms and wheels of cheese or whatever they are, they don't want to be caught and used in your food. They will run away from you.
Maybe PETA will discover this game and create a Chef Noir spinoff where you play as him.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I don't know. Do you actually... Well, you capture eggs, at least. Do you capture any other, like, meat products in this game?
Well, I mean, you capture cheese, which is...
I guess, you know, cheese is animal-derived. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But not, like, a little, like, haunch of meat that's hopping around that has little eyes on it, right?
I don't know. I only got so far in the game, so I couldn't say...
Yeah, me too. That's the thing. I only got so far in the game, too, so I can't say with, like, the later levels have anything that would be incompatible with at least a vegetarian lifestyle, so... And yeah, so, like, this is, like you said, it's kind of a very simple, almost like kind of throwback arcade-ish platform game. Not really single screen, but not far from it. I think this would be very appropriate as a Game Boy game, certainly.
Yeah, I think is, you know, like an arcade-style platformer of this era, this feels like the way you do it. I mean, like, really, this game we featured because it was a game that kind of came out of nowhere. For me, anyway, mm-hmm. I'd never heard of it before. We were doing research for this show, and I played it, and I thought, yeah, you know, this is a cute little thing. This is a fun little cute game. But I have to say, the more I play it, the more I wonder if I was maybe being a little bit too generous giving it the feature episode treatment, because, you know, it's very slight, you know?
So this is what I'll say about this game. Mm-hmm. I had kind of an arc with it over the course of the, like, 45 minutes or so that I played of it. Where I started out and I was honestly kind of annoyed with it because Chef Pierre moves very slowly. There's not really any kind of like barriers that keep the food from continuing to want to run away from you. Like they can't like get to like the edge of a platform and stop. They'll just like go off of it and keep going. It's got little things like that where I'm like, God, why is this game not like a little bit smoother or something? And then I got kind of into it. I started, like, enjoying that you can kind of, like, sneak up on the food and surprise it so it can't get away from you. I started appreciating the level layouts a little bit more. I liked the kind of, like, almost borderline, like, Yoshi's Island-ish, like, children's cartoon drawing sort of visual style to it. And I was pretty much enjoying it for, like, a while. And then I reached a point where a new level started, and I was like, absolutely not. I'm not going to play any more of this. I've reached my limit with Out to Lunch all at once. Like, not that I hated it, not that I thought it was bad or anything, just like, I just don't need to play any more of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few levels, but they don't vary all that much. And for a game that mm-hmm. is, you know, is limited, let's say, as this one is,
yeah,
you really want everything, all the elements there to be perfect, and they very much are not. Like, Chef Pierre slides around way more than I feel like he should, even when he's not on an icy platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I do kind of like that you slide around more on icy platforms, but I don't disagree with you. He's sort of annoying to control. I found it weirdly difficult to direct him when you jump off of a springboard. I don't know if you had this problem too, but I kept getting like caught on the edges of platforms and not quite getting to where I needed to for a while. And yeah, like I also don't understand really why the little net that he has to use to collect the food is not a thing you start the levels with. I don't understand why you have to retrieve that before you can move on and like start the level proper. Cause it's like in the levels I played, at least, it was never challenging to get the net.
Yeah.
It was just like a thing you had to do before you could actually properly start playing the video game.
Yeah, we kind of had this criticism with Aladdin last time where he has that sheet that lets him, mm-hmm. you know, glide down.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I think it's way more egregious here
because you need the net. Like the sheet is like a useful thing that increases your mobility in Aladdin. The net is like the fundamental mechanic of this game, basically.
Yeah, I feel like, if you'll pardon the pun, this one needed maybe a little bit more time to bake. Yeah, even back in the day, I think that the value proposition here for this being like a full-priced cartridge. I don't know if that math quite adds up, you know? Like, no. I like the idea of this game. I think it's cute. And maybe, like, if somebody wanted to re-release this game after, you know, tightening the controls a bit with, like, remakes of other classic food-themed arcade games like Food Fight and Burger Time. Yeah. Maybe you've got, like, a nice, fun compilation package there.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, none of these games are probably going to keep you going for too terribly long, but there's something there. There's something fun there.
Totally. Absolutely. I do think that, assuming the Game Boy game was pretty much the same as this, which I bet it was, I think this probably was an okay Game Boy game.
Yeah, yeah. This probably worked a lot better as a Game Boy game. I can see that.
I think it's just kind of out of place as, like, a full-on, like, Super Nintendo console game.
I agree. So I don't know if I've got a whole lot more to say about it. You know, like, the presentation is fine, but again, you know, like,
it's cute.
The game itself, it's pretty slight.
Uh-huh.
Did you have anything else?
No, I don't really. It was okay. And like I said, I definitely sort of reached my limit with it, which sometimes that happens with games. But I didn't mind my time with it. I thought it was pretty fun. I had also never heard of this game before it came up on the release calendar. So I'm glad to have played it. If you just are just in the mood for something very simple, very straightforward, I would say you could check this out. It would be you'd probably have a good time. But that's it. That's all I've got to say.
I do feel like maybe this one stood out to me just because at this point in the SNES life cycle, this feels kind of unique. You know, like, sure, I don't feel like there's a lot of arcade-y platformers like this. A lot of the platformers are very console platformer in the sense that, like, they're all, you know, very, you know, long levels where you're going from point A to point B. You know, not always terribly interesting. A lot of them based on existing properties or very clearly aping, you know, the look or feel of an existing game. This one doesn't feel like any of those. And so it was kind of unique. And I think that's why it stood out enough for me to want to do a featured episode on it. But
that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's about as nice as I can be to it at this point, unfortunately.
No, that's reasonable. I feel I'm in pretty much the same spot with it, I think.
Yeah, so where do we think this one should go?
Do you think it's good enough to be a C tier game, or would you say this is a D?
Oh, I would not say this is a D. I think charm alone elevates it to a C.
Okay. Well, do you think it goes higher? Do you think it goes higher then? Do you think this would be a B, or are we talking C for charm here?
My initial thought was like, maybe this is competent enough to be a B, but like you, I got so worn out on it so quickly. I don't think I can put it in B. So I think C is probably a good place for it.
All right. Out to Lunch. Chef Pierre is out. Pierre Le Chef is Out to Lunch. Joins the C tier alongside games like Super Buster Brothers and actually quite a few direct arcade adaptations are in this tier. So, you know, we've got Super Smash TV and Joe and Mac. All those are in here, too. So it's in good company. Do you have anything else you wanted to add before we move on to our next game?
I don't know. I could say something in a funny French accent, but I got nothing. So, why don't we just move on? We will move on from the world of French cuisine to the world of Japanese manga.
Yeah.
As we talk about Ranma 1/2 Hard Battle.
We got a game here. It's a fighting game based on the long-running Ranma 1/2 series. And where does this come from?
So this one comes from the NCS Corporation, is the developer of this game.
Okay.
I don't have a whole lot about them.
I don't think there is much about them. I was looking up information. I could not find much of anything. I think they just made some games that were all kind of similar to this one, and then they sort of went away.
Yeah, I think sometime in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. they decided to focus on business software instead of games.
Yeah, that did happen to a number of kind of mid-range independent game studios in Japan in the early 2000s, so I'm not terribly surprised that was the fate here. I am interested in the fact that this Ranma game came out here in the U.S. without any kind of, like, attempt to, like, Americanize it at all. Does that seem as strange to you as it does to me?
A little bit, yeah. I'm pretty sure that the Ranma manga had been localized by this point. And, you know, whenever we're talking about, you know, like, the first blank, you know, there's always an asterisk attached to it. I don't know if it was, like, one of the first mangas to be brought over here. It almost certainly wasn't, I'm sure. But it came out over here in, like, comic book form, okay. because the idea of just, like, buying graphic novels in the, you know, more traditional Japanese manga format was not a thing over here yet. And they also reversed all of the art before putting English text in it.
So it would read left to right, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually why, like, if you buy Ranma manga now in English, it's still read from left to right because it would have just been too much of a hassle to re-swap it all. Yeah.
Oh, yep. Really? They're still using that same translation then. That's kind of interesting. But I guess if the translation was fine, then, you know, why not? And man, there's a whole lot of Ranma, isn't there? This is this is a series from the kind of mm-hmm. hugely prolific creator Rumiko Takahashi, who is also responsible for series such as Usore Yatsura and Inuyasha. And yeah, man, she has just been, like, cranking these things out since the 80s. Like,
yeah, and I think she's still at it today.
I think she is, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like, when we say, like, she created, we mean she wrote and illustrated all these. Like, this is typically, I think this is pretty typical of mangaka, right?
It is absolutely pretty typical, but it's still remarkable when you consider the scale of the stuff that she's made. And of course, all of these things had very popular anime adaptations. You know, they're huge. They're huge things. No, so I know that at least one of the Usore Yatsura movies came out in was dubbed into English. Because I had seen that as a child, and was very confused by it because it was a really fascinating, weird movie that did not ultimately bear much resemblance to that manga. But, the point is, it's not terribly representative. So I bet that Ranma was the first of her stuff that came out here that was just, here it is, here's the thing, enjoy. You know, for Americans.
Yeah, well, I mean, it definitely says something that, like, the first Ranma game for the Super Famicom made it over here, but they completely changed everything. They turned it into the game Street Combat, which we talked about a while ago.
We did talk about that, yeah.
But they didn't do that to this one. So apparently Ranma was enough of a thing over here by that point that they were like, yeah, you know, someone might buy a Ranma game.
Yeah.
There was actually a third Ranma game that came out on the Super Famicom that did not make it over here at all, because I think either the company that was localizing it or the company that published it, which is DTMC, which seems to be a very short-lived company, so this might be the case, is that they just went out of business before they could get it over here. So I actually went into more depth about this game in particular and the Ranma series as a whole on the series Play Comics a long time ago. That show, I'm pretty sure that show is still around. So I will try to remember to have a link to it in our show notes for this one once we get our proper website up and running, of course. But
yeah,
if you want to know more about that, check out that episode that I did with Chris over at Play Comics. It was a fun episode. And we talked a lot about Ranma. I read a good chunk of Ranma to prepare to be on that show and have since forgotten a lot of it. So apologies for that.
You know, it's interesting. Despite the fact that I'm more or less like a lifelong anime fan, I've never seen any of the Ranma anime or read any of the manga. So all of my knowledge of it is like pretty secondhand. what do you, can you give us like a high level overview of it before we get into talking about the game? Just like what the basic premise is.
Ranma Saotome is a young teenager who's also been a martial artist all his life, trained by his father. He is betrothed to Akane Tendo since they were both very young. Akane is the daughter of his father's friend and kind of like a rival dojo owner, master. Let's go with master, we'll say.
Sure.
These two are getting brought together as young teenagers because their dads promised that they would marry each other. They are not interested in each other at all. They are more interested in fighting. Mm-hmm. But also, a little wrinkle here, Ranma turns into a girl whenever he is exposed to cold water and turns back into a boy when he's exposed to hot water. His father similarly turns into a panda under similar circumstances because they were cursed by hot springs. There were a series of hot springs in which various people and things drowned in them, cursing them. So anybody who falls into that specific hot spring then turns into that person or animal whenever they are doused in cold water. It's weird, and that comes into play with a few other things, like other characters turn into other animals. I think the character Shampoo turns into a cat. The character Taro, I think his name is, turns into a duck.
Okay.
I want to say the guy who gets lost a lot. So yeah, there's a lot of things like that. There's also weird rival ninja clans and martial art clans. There's one where everybody has the name of hair care products for some reason. And also because we are dealing with teenagers, literally everyone is horny for everyone else.
Good times.
Except for the two people who are betrothed to each other.
All right. Good times. Good times.
You know, we've talked a lot about fighting games on this show. Street Fighter II obviously like really put fighting games on the map and made them the big thing in video games for a while, that a lot of people wanted to try and capture that lightning in a bottle for themselves. Mm-hmm. Most of those games did not work very well. Mm-hmm. I would say Street Combat, the game that was made from the first Ranma game, absolutely was pretty terrible from my recollection.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't remember where we put that one on the list, but I don't think it was high.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. But this one, I think this one is considerably better.
I think this is okay. We've played a lot of fighting games, and a lot of them have been bad, like you just said. And I think this is better than average in a lot of ways. I think it's... it is pretty slow, and I'm not a huge fan of fighting games that map jump to a button instead of just pressing up, just as like a thing I'm like comfortable with. And unfortunately, this game does fall into that. But I don't think it feels bad to play. And I think that the Ranma license imbues this with a lot of personality that I think takes it quite a long way.
Yeah. Also, to push back on your criticism a little bit, what if I told you that you could switch the control scheme so that up was jump and there wasn't a jump button?
Okay. You know, I should have investigated that a little bit more. I didn't know that. So that's good. That takes away one of my issues with the game, certainly.
Yeah. Still don't know why that wasn't the default control scheme. There's also the whole thing where, like, your attacks are basically just strong and fast, so
yeah,
you don't have a whole lot of options there. All of the special moves are accomplished with pretty simple, either like rapidly pushing buttons, pushing the two attack buttons simultaneously, or just a simple push a direction and the attack button at the same time.
It's pretty basic, yeah.
Not a lot of complexity there, which, you know, I mean, could actually be a good thing, depending on who you are. I mean, there's definitely been, a sort of move towards trying to make fighting games a little bit more accessible to people recently. And so, I don't know, maybe keeping special moves a little bit simpler isn't a bad thing.
I think it's fair to say that the skill ceiling on this is probably pretty low, though. Like, I think this is sort of like a kind of a what you see is what you get sort of game in a lot of ways, where, you know, you're not going to necessarily unlock a bunch of really profoundly different strategies for how to fight in this game the more you play it. But yeah, it's a pretty charming, simple fighting game. The character designs, the animation, and a lot of like the presentational stuff around the matches really, really kind of, you know, gives a shot in the arm too.
There's a lot of Ranma in here, which, you know, I agree, definitely gives this game a lot more personality than, you know, that generic street combat game did.
Yeah.
You know, I like how, again, I think his name is Taro, how his opening animation has him facing the wrong direction, because one of his character quirks in the manga is that he has no sense of direction and will just like start walking off in a direction, not knowing if he's actually going someplace, and it will sometimes take him hours to get to his destination as a result of this.
Oh, that's fine.
One weird inclusion here is the character King, who was like the villain of one very particular story arc in Ranma and is not featured ever again.
Yeah,
I'm guessing maybe that was just the story arc that happened to be going on
probably
when the game was made.
I don't know, maybe they liked his design and just thought he'd be fun to have in the game, but I think it's more likely that you're right, that just was what was in the moment going on in Ranma, so they put him in the game. Yeah, it's odd. One thing I like about this game is that everybody gets their own, not just ending to the single player like story mode, they also get an opening. There's like a little kind of scene at the beginning that explains why they in particular are trying to fight all of these other Ranma characters, and the reasons all seem pretty bad to me, but they are there and it's very funny, and you get little personalized like after fight exchanges between the characters after you finish each fight. So good stuff.
Yeah, the story, such as it is, feels very loose weave and like maybe not brilliantly translated, perhaps. I don't know.
No, I don't think so for the most part. Like I went through the whole story mode as Ranma's dad, who is a panda, and who cannot speak. So every one of his like after fight like banter things is like the person he's just beaten says, you know, something about how crazy it is that they got beat up by a panda bear, and he has a thought, and it's like, yeah, that's right, I am stronger than you, I just wish pandas could speak. You know, and it's like, it's funny, but like they definitely don't vary that up very much with like his responses. So yeah
and like some of the stories are like borderline nonsensical. Like I remember going through the game as Shampoo, and I like feeling like this doesn't even make sense. I don't know what they were actually trying to convey here with with her story. I don't get it.
I mean, isn't her reason for fighting just that she thinks Ranma will respect her more and want to marry her if she shows that she can beat up him and everybody he knows?
Like, I don't even think it's that, because like the school principal is sort of the catalyst for all of these things, including like the stories for characters who are not students at his school, like Ranma's dad and King, which doesn't make a lot of sense either. But yeah, I don't know. Like for Ranma's, I think like both versions of Ranma that are playable in this game, like I think he just promises that he'll give them credit, you know, for schoolwork, if they can you know, beat up all these other students that he's not crazy about. But then just like the end of the story is just, this isn't you can't get through life by cheating like that, man. So no, I'm not going to give you credit after all. And then Ranma punches him, and that's the story.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. No, I like the way the one for Ranma's dad ends, because it ends up with him just like very, very satisfied walking down the street, being very proud that he showed everybody how much stronger he is than all these young people. And he passes like a warning poster that's like, warning, dangerous escaped panda bear on the loose. So it's
that
like,
pretty good.
Yeah, no, Yeah, so that's fun. But yeah, I mean, yeah, none of this is like, you know, particularly high level storytelling, but it's you know, it's fun, it's characterful, and it you know, it is all over the game. So I appreciate that. And yeah, unfortunately, I don't really have much else to say about like the way it plays. I think the graphics, beyond like the good character designs, I think the graphics are fine, basically. The backgrounds are a little flat looking. The music is okay. The animation, I wish, was a little bit more fluid, but it's fine for what it is. And yeah, I thought it was overall kind of pretty mid, but not in a bad way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think with, you know, some of the fighting aspects of this game, like, I think it's almost starting to get it. Like, it's almost, we're almost seeing these other studios start to understand, like, what makes a good roster, what makes a balanced fighter. You know, like, you've got, like, you know, like Ranma's female version, who's a little bit faster, has some good reach, but isn't quite as strong as some of the slower characters. Akane is kind of a slower character, but she's got some moves that can help her clear some distance pretty quickly. She's also got like a double roundhouse kick combo as her strong attack. It's like her neutral strong, which actually like moves her forward a little bit, which I thought was kind of neat.
That's cool. Yeah.
I thought that was a useful thing for a slower character to have. Mm-hmm. You know, again, like there's not a lot of complexity to the fighting. You can throw people when you're close enough by pressing attack buttons. But you know, like I think there's like an understanding of some of the fundamentals here that are starting to be cemented and you know, and I think maybe that's a good reason why this game is a lot better than its predecessor, Street Combat, because I don't think your, you know, just average upstart fighting game had that down yet.
No, I agree. And I mean, like, it is really striking when you compare something like this to those older non-Street Fighter fighting games, because like this feels like a fighting game. Like, it feels like it has internalized at least some of the concepts from Street Fighter II, like you said. Whereas, like, things like Street Combat or, like, the Combat Tribes, for example, really felt like they were more on the level of, like, kind of like, I don't know, people who were very used to the way that, like, belt scrollers worked, trying to just dump more moves into those characters for the purpose of creating a fighting game, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like they understood that, you know, you have some punch buttons and some kick buttons and you can do special moves, but not a good understanding of how you make those into, you know,
like a system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Where this one, I feel like we're starting to get there. And I want to say, I think I read that this actually got some play at Evo back in 2018.
That's kind of interesting. I'd be curious to see what that looks like, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, no, like, not on the main stage.
Maybe, but no, of course not. But, I mean, maybe the skill ceiling for this is higher than I thought it was. So, yeah, I'd be curious to see what people who, like, really know how to play fighting games would do with this. So,
yeah,
I don't really have much else to say about this one. Do you want to head on over to the list and place this bad boy and or girl?
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to see, like, do we have any? Oh, yeah, we got World Heroes in the B tier right now. And I think this is at least as good as World Heroes was, or at least I remember it being. Do you think so?
Yeah, I would agree with that. World Heroes, I think, was another one where we kind of spent a lot of it talking about, like, hey, this one actually kind of gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this one presentationally is certainly better than World Heroes. And I think the roster is honestly better. I think it's, like, a little more varied and interesting in terms of, like, how people play.
It's kind of unfair because they've got, you know, like, a whole, you know, roster of characters already, you know, ready to go.
Yeah,
but
sure. I mean, of course, but that, you know, the end result is the end result, though. So So, yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that I'm pretty comfortable with Ranma 1/2 Hard Battle going in the B tier.
All right. So, yeah, Ranma 1/2 Hard Battle in the B tier. Congratulations. I'm trying to think. This might be like one of the first like fighting games based on a license that we've talked about.
Yeah, I think so. Most of them have been original properties. So, yeah, I mean, you know, fighting games based on licenses would go on to be very common. But yeah, this is one of the earliest ones that it might be the first one we've played on the show, certainly. So
yeah, I'm not sure how many more we're going to have either. I know we've got a Ninja Turtles one eventually coming up.
Yeah, we got the Ninja Turtles one, and we will eventually have the Power Rangers one.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there will be a Power Rangers one. That's right. I almost forgot about that. Wasn't there like a Sailor Moon fighting game, but it didn't come out over here? Or was that a brawler?
I don't know. I've never played that one. The only Sailor Moon game I've ever actually played from like the Super Famicom era is the RPG. So I don't know about the action ones.
It's honestly like I think it's weird that we got a Ranma game, but we didn't get any of the Sailor Moon games because people knew what Sailor Moon was back then.
Sailor Moon was on television. Like you could buy Sailor Moon toys in like the store.
Yeah.
So that is strange to me. Yeah.
I mean, the answer there is
sexism, I'm guessing.
Yeah, the whole perception that like, oh, girls don't play video games, so we shouldn't even bring this over here. Yeah, that's kind of my.
Yeah,
I would guess that is the reason, and that sucks. Mm-hmm. But
yep.
With all that out of the way, I guess we have one more game to look at, one more fighting game to look at.
Indeed.
And it's I think this may be, with the exception of the game that would later replace it, is the only game on the Super Nintendo to have an actual theme song with lyrics. So let's listen to that. That is fun. It's short, but, you know, it kind of has to be. There's only so much room on that ROM, you know?
It's true. It's true.
But yeah, we are talking about Clay Fighter. This one comes to us from developer Visual Concepts, who got their start in 1988 in California and would later be purchased by Sega to make sports games for the Dreamcast, since EA was not interested in supporting the Dreamcast. And then Sega later sold the company to Take-Two Interactive in 2005 after it decided it was also not interested in supporting the Dreamcast anymore.
Poor Dreamcast.
Yeah, poor Dreamcast. Ah, it was a good system. I liked it.
It was.
Anyway, this game was published by Interplay, and they happen to be the topic of today's deep dive. So I'm just going to warn everybody right out of the gate here. Like, this story is kind of confusing. There's a lot to it that I just don't understand. There's a lot of acquisitions of the company, a lot of acquisitions by the company, and I probably missed like more than half of them, so I apologize for that. Unlike Ocean, nobody has written like one nice tidy book about this company yet that I can, you know, just regurgitate for you. So
which given some of the stuff they made is honestly a surprise.
It kind of is. Yeah, like they were around. They've had their name on a lot of important franchises over the years. So It is kind of weird that, you know, there isn't a little bit more love for the brand, I guess you could say. But let's start with the beginning of the Interplay story, which starts with the end of the Boom Corporation story, which is a pretty short story consisting of about three games released for the VIC-20 in the early 80s before giving up the ghost. Four former employees of Boone, Brian Fargo, Becky, Berger Heinemann, Jay Patel, and Troy Worrell, decided to strike out on their own and create their own company. I do want to do a quick detour on Becky Heinemann for just a moment.
Oh yeah, she's a legend.
Yeah, her story is interesting. I think we talked about her a little bit when we talked about RPM Racing, which it's kind of unfortunate that her name keeps coming up in the context of less than great video games, because she deserves to be remembered for better stuff than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But her entry into the video game industry is pretty interesting as well. And also, she happened to do an interview with GameDeveloper.com at one point, which is very accessible. So, you know, she gets some special treatment because of that here. Heinemann had developed a love for games and software from an early age. And in 1983, she entered a Space Invaders tournament and blew the competition out of the water, despite not having a whole lot of interest in the game Space Invaders. This got her a meeting with folks with EGM. She ended up consulting for a few pieces for EGM before ending up with a company called Avalon Hill to help them develop games for the Atari 2600, which is a skill that not many other folks had back then. After that, she'd end up at Boone, where, you know, they would lay her and all of her coworkers off when shutting down so that the four of them could start their own company. And also, when she did all of this, she was still a teenager.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, real prodigy, Becky Heinemann. So, anyway, that brings us back to the collapse of Boone and the rise of Interplay. The company started the way a lot of companies did back then, by mostly doing conversions. Their first big contract came from Activision to produce original text adventures for the company. These ended up being Mind Shadow, The Tracer Sanction, and Borrowed Time in 1985, which were built on some of Fargo's old code. Meanwhile, Heinemann was also at work on Racing Destruction Set, contracted by EA, building it from the ground up. According to Moby Games, the same year would also be the year that the company would put out the first Bard's Tale game, one of Interplay's first big franchises that would see sequels and an enduring legacy. By the following year, with the release of Task Times in Tonetown, Interplay was becoming a well-known name in text-based story-driven RPGs. It wasn't long before Interplay started publishing games produced by other studios. Some versions of Delphine Software's Out of This World series were published by the company, though they still developed some games in-house as well, like several Star Trek games, and the Battle Chess series, which I just... Remember Battle Chess? It was chess, but pieces were animated characters that just murdered each other.
Yeah, wonderful concept for a game, honestly.
Yeah, it was fantastic. How did we get Chess Master, not Battle Chess, on the SNES? That's what I want to know. I
truly don't know. Truly no idea. Yeah.
They acquired Earthworm Jim developer Shiny Entertainment in 1995. By the late 90s, they were publishing BioWare's Baldur's Gate, as well as developing and publishing the first Fallout game. An internal studio, Black Isle Studios, would create the sequel a year later. They also formed Interplay Films in 1998 in the hope that they'd be able to release movies based on some of their properties, like Redneck Rampage, Descent, and the aforementioned Fallout. Oh, you sweet summer child, you.
Yeah.
Yeah, for reasons that will be apparent very shortly, the studio never got to make those movies. Despite releasing some classic games, the company was in danger of going bankrupt in 1998. French-based publisher Titus swooped in to purchase a controlling interest in Interplay in 1999, which saw Fargo step down as president of the company, but retain his status as chairman and CEO, while Heinemann left the company altogether to found her own company called Contraband Entertainment. Interplay's problems continued, and eventually Fargo left to found In Exile Entertainment in 2002, leaving Titus co-founder Herve Keen to try to right the ship, selling Shiny Entertainment that year and shutting down Black Isle Studios. Interplay was briefly shut down by the state of California for not paying its workers in 2004. Titus would go bankrupt in 2005, causing... Okay, here's one of these things I do not understand. Titus goes bankrupt in 2005... Interplay is technically a subsidiary of Titus at this point, but buys up Titus's IP from them as they go bankrupt.
God, that's confusing.
Yeah, I don't even know how that works. And unsurprisingly, that left Interplay with a lot of debt that they couldn't pay back. Surprise, surprise.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
God.
So they sold the rights to Fallout to Bethesda in 2007 to pay off some of their creditors. Bethesda, by this point, had already had the rights to publish Fallout games, but at this point, they just had to sell the whole IP completely. Somehow, the company stumbled along until 2013 when it tried launching a Kickstarter for a new version of Battle Chess, but couldn't get it funded. Finally, in 2016, they started selling off pretty much all of their remaining IP. Apparently, they still are around and have a few IP left that they're trying to reboot. Whether or not that actually happens, we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, it's just a question of, like, who works there now? Like, who do they have? I mean, I assume they would just need to contract any of those IPs out to, like, a third-party developer to make them. Because, yeah, I don't know what is that company at this point, aside from, like, a thing that exists on paper and owns a few licenses, you know?
Yeah, I don't really know. I'm going to say I thought I read something where Brian Fargo was maybe interested in trying to buy back Interplay and some of the IP that they had lost, but I don't know if anything ever came of that. And I know that, like, a lot of the IP that they sold, like Clay Fighter, would end up in, like, a lot of compilations. A lot of Shiny Entertainment games end up, you know, like, on, like, the Retrocade, you know, cartridges for the Retrocade. Something called AntStream. There's a lot of those things on AntStream, which is kind of like a classic game streaming service. That's where you can find that stuff. But yeah, it's weird. Just, you know, I'm not a business guy, but, like, a company that released some really classic games that seemed to have been, like, in pretty dire financial straits for most of its existence, it looks like, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't get it either.
But hey, that's capitalism for you. And that's our leftist politics of the day. But that will wrap up the deep dive for today.
All right. Well, let's talk about Clay Fighter then.
Yeah.
Clay Fighter, as you already alluded to, great theme song.
And as you might guess from the name, it is a fighting game where the characters are all made out of clay. And it's actually visually kind of neat.
It is, actually. It looks cool. It looks... This is a game that always looks cooler when I actually see it than I think it does in my memories.
Yeah, one of the few games like that, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a colorful cast of characters here with a sort of a an overlying theme of these being circus performers who got mutated by a meteor of clay.
Yeah.
Not sure how, like, snowmen fit into that, but... Yeah, that's fine.
I don't know. It was, you know, there was just a snowman off to the side, and it got mutated, and
an Elvis impersonator, you know, that classic thing that you see at the circus, an Elvis impersonator.
Know, everyone loves the Elvis impersonator at the circus. It's like one of the main things people talk about. I think about half of these fit the circus theme. Okay. You got a clown, obviously.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You've got a strong man. I guess that's what Tiny's supposed to be.
Yep.
You got Helga. I don't really know what Helga's role in the circus thing is. She seems more like an opera singer, but
it's very musically themed circus.
Yeah, yeah. And Taffy is that's a thing they sell at the circus. So yeah, or. Possibly. I don't know. It's a candy. He's candy, I think. I don't know what he is, but he kind of creeps me out, and I like him.
Yep. Yeah. He's a candy man. A candy man can.
Yep.
Fixes it with love. Makes the world taste good. But yeah, so two of the main standouts are, like, maybe the weirdest additions to a circus-themed cast, which is, you know, Bad Mr. Frosty and the Blob, who is just a blob. Which, I mean, like,
yeah,
you've got a claymation game. Yeah, put the Blob in there. Put a guy who can just turn into whatever he wants to turn into in there.
The Blob, I think, is maybe the best-looking character in the game. I think his animations are the best. So, yeah. And we also had... There's one other guy we did not mention. What's his... Ichabod Clay.
Oh, right. Who is Ichabod sort of like Clay.
So Bad Mr. Frosty's a really swole snowman. Ichabod Clay is sort of a scarecrow guy with a pumpkin for a head. And they're both kind of similarly sort of like built, you know? That's your cast. And I think this whole approach works really well. This is essentially using... kind of a similar sort of tack that Mortal Kombat did, where all of the fighters, all their animations are composed of, like, essentially, like, strung together, like images like of real life things. In Mortal Kombat's case, it was, you know, people that they had filmed doing martial arts moves. In this, it was posed clay models. And yeah, I think it's very charming.
Yeah, I think it's got a really cool look to it. It's a really novel idea. It was almost certainly a ton of work for the people animating everything.
Yeah.
And modeling all the characters and mm-hmm. everything. So, I mean, I've got a ton of respect for that. As a fighting game, this thing kind of falls apart.
Yeah, like it sure does. Like
a poorly made clay model.
Yeah, it's honestly pretty rough to play, pretty frustrating. And yeah, this one, it is doing like an okay job of being like, you know, a cover band version of Street Fighter, but it really does not seem to have the fundamentals down very well.
No, not really. There's some things, you know, that like you can tell, like, oh, this was probably an idea from Street Fighter, like the idea of, you know, brief status effects, like the way characters catch on fire in Street Fighter, characters mm-hmm. can get cut in half by the blob's saw blades in this game. In some ways, it's more complex than Ranma 1/2. Like, you have more punch and kicks available to you. But in another way, it's a heck of a lot jankier than Ranma 1/2 was.
Yeah, it does. It feels rough. It feels rough to play, and like it is. I don't know. I don't like how unpredictable some of the like hitboxes and stuff feel to me in this game. Like, I find it hard to get into a rhythm with it, you know?
Yeah. And for as much as we praise the presentation, one problem that I have with it is that I just don't feel like there's enough like in between cells of animation to make this look smooth. It
can look real rough. And I mean, from what I read, I was trying to read up on whatever info there is about the actual like behind the scenes production of the animations for this game. And mm-hmm. I assumed this was more of like a normal sort of like the thing you do when you're making like a stop motion movie, where like essentially the puppet, the clay figures are kind of like posable like dolls that they can move, you know, they have like armatures underneath them that you can like move a little bit for each new cell of film. But it seems like from the language that I saw used to describe these, that at least for this first game, they actually just made models that were in the different poses that the characters go into and then just photographed them. And that, I think, contributes to this problem because, yeah, you're right. The actual animation is not very good. It feels very choppy, and it feels like there's very little in the way of transition between moves here.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously we were never going to get, you know, like Wallace and Gromit level. I mean,
it's never going to look like the Nightmare Before Christmas or, yeah, Wallace yeah, and Gromit exactly. here or yeah, anything.
They're just, it wasn't enough room to put that many, you know, cells of animation in there. But we've seen with games like Street Fighter 2, like there aren't even as many, you know, individual animated sprites of each character in Street Fighter 2 as there are in the arcade game. But they still somehow made it look pretty good. They made it work.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the point that like you almost don't realize it at when you're playing Street Fighter 2 mm-hmm. on the SNES. So yeah. I feel like they could have done better. And, you know, maybe if they hadn't taken the approach of just modeling each individual pose as its own model and instead had taken a more traditional, you know, clay animation approach to things. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could have done that. I don't know. I don't know.
It seems like an odd choice to me personally. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like it made more work for them for
yeah, less return. Right? Yeah, but I don't know. I also, another thing that I don't really like about this game is that it feels like there is no real sense of reality to the backgrounds. Like, they look very hand-drawn in a way that is, like, almost kind of amateurish looking, you know? And I kind of wish those were also a photograph of like a diorama or something. Like, just go all the way with the look if you're going to do that.
Yeah, with the exception of the characters themselves, the presentation here is pretty lackluster. All the fonts look very plain.
Yeah.
This comes into stark contrast with the game that will replace this one, the mm-hmm. tournament edition of Clay yeah. Fighter that's going to come out later on, where I think they do a lot of that. Like, the font is more of like, looks like it was molded out of clay as well.
Yeah.
The backgrounds are a lot more detailed. This does feel like a game that they were maybe trying to rush to get out the door in some ways. And
yeah, it definitely does. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that tournament edition feels almost like an apology for that. Like, hey, this was our real intention. This is what we wanted to do. And we didn't have enough time to really
right.
finish things up. So, you know, we'll obviously have to compare and contrast when we get to that game, but yeah, it's pretty obvious just looking at this one that
it doesn't feel finished. Yeah.
Yeah. The backgrounds here just do not have nearly the same level of detail and care that the individual characters do.
No, but I mean, there's good stuff about the presentation beyond the models. Like, the announcer, I think, is really good. He sounds really clear. Yeah. He says the names of all the characters mm-hmm. when they come on stage, you know. I like the little kind of in-between match thing showing the kind of all of the stages sort of like laid out next to each other and like the next one lighting up. You know, there's some good stuff there. But yeah, I think overall this just does not really live up to the first impression that like the look of the characters gives you.
Yeah, it's a shame because, like I said, you know, those character models look like they were a lot of work, and I respect yeah. the heck out of that. But
yeah,
everything else about this game just really falls flat. Like the announcer might say, feeling flat. And yes, yes it does.
Yes it does. Yeah.
Going back to the announcer, I do like his repertoire of witty remarks whenever you get a perfect. Like he'll start saying things like that wasn't even a contest or something like that.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Time to call the hospital.
There's a real, you know, in your face 90s bad boy attitude to this thing. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, it's a circus, but it's messed up, you know. Very kind of like, I don't know, MTV Nicktoon-ish, maybe. Now, I think that it's a little too crass feeling for like a Nicktoons thing, but it definitely feels like it's got some tood to it, you know?
Yeah, definitely more Ren and Stimpy than Doug, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely going for that. And, you know, I think some of it works. I think it'll work a little bit better in some of the future games. And then it completely falls apart in the Nintendo 64 version, which got real, real racist, folks.
Real racist. And that was the end of the series, in fact. They did a sequel. Yeah, so the path, the trajectory of Clay Fighter, there's this game, there's the tournament edition, there's T2 Judgment Clay, which I think was also on the 16-bit. C2. Yeah, of course, C2. C2 Judgment Clay. I don't know why I said T2. That was dumb.
Well, because that was the thing that they were parodying. But
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that one will come out on the Super Nintendo. And then there was 63 and a third for the Nintendo 64.
Which was a disaster and was the end of the series. So
they also did a remake of 63 and a third called Sculptor's Cut, which was only available at Blockbuster and as a result is extremely rare and I think the most expensive N64 game out there for collectors. So anyone wanting to get a full set of N64 games, that one's going to be problematic.
Don't do that, folks. That's not worth it. Just find a different thing to get a complete collection of so you don't have to spend like $1,000 on a copy of Clay Fighter Sculptor 63 and a third. Yeah,
pretty awful game.
Yeah,
it's time to go to the list.
I think it is.
So clearly this is not as good as Ranma 1/2
or World Heroes,
so it's not going in the B tier.
Yeah, no.
Do we have any fighting games in the C tier?
Let's see. Possibly not.
I'm not sure that we do. Like, yeah, fighting games have been a real feast or famine kind of thing here.
Truly, yeah.
But I'll be honest, I don't know if I can say I think this is good enough to be C tier.
I don't know if I can either. I don't think it's an F tier game. I don't think it's bad in that overall way. But I do think it might well be a D tier game.
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, this puts it in company with Street Combat, which we did not have very nice things to say today.
No.
So,
I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, like, the effort that went into modeling those characters almost makes me want to give it, you know, like a few mercy points to put it into C tier, sure, you know, but yeah. I don't know. It's,
I mean, please go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, we could maybe just like anticipate that similar to original Street Fighter II, the World Warrior, this thing is pretty much going to be replaced by the tournament edition, mm-hmm, because it is this game, but just better.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So we could almost just decide to put this in unranked now in anticipation of that if we wanted to.
I think we should put it in D for now, and then if I keep wanting to call that one Sculptor's Cut, even though I know it's not. If Tournament Edition really does turn it around for us, then maybe Original Clay Fighter just goes away, and Tournament Edition ends up in C tier at that point. We're higher, who can say?
Okay, so Clay Fighter is going into the D tier. Big old D for doughy mess.
Good. Very good. I couldn't come up with anything for D and Clay Fighter, so good job.
You should have put like a chef character in there who makes things out of dough.
Right?
They could have had Chef Pierre. I mean,
they will eventually later have
later entries in Clay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Earthworm Jim and Booger Man, yeah, so why not?
Right? I'm going to say that could have been a way for Clay Fighter to keep on going. Just keep putting in more additional characters that had completely sort of run out the clock on it being able to have their own series.
Maybe like a mascot fighter, Clay Fighter game would have been like, could have been like Interplay's Last Hail Mary, right? You know?
Yeah. Everybody was doing them in the early 2000s. So yeah. But yeah, I think that's pretty much it. That's going to do it for us. What are we going to be doing next time? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so next time we're going to wrap up November of 1993 with all of the games that we decided were not worth giving a feature episode to. First time we've done this, and this is where we're really going to see if this new format actually works.
All right, so we hope you join us for that. I'm not going to list all those games here, but there are a number of them, so we're going to be kind of going through them rapid fire, and we hope you enjoy that. We hope you join us for what's bound to be a very different sort of Snescapades episode.
I hope we enjoy it.
I hope we do too. Yeah. Until then, I'm Emmy Zero.
I'm Chase Keys.
Play it loud.
Our intro-outro song is How Now Brown Cow by Technoaxe, who very generously offers a ton of great music for free and royalty-free at technoaxe.com. That's TEKNOAXE.com.